Hello, I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Spaces, episode 201. Thanks for coming back, and to any new listeners, welcome. It's a new year, new mood, so we have some new music to get us going. For those that have been around for a while, thank you for your patience between some personal challenges and complete exhaustion from putting together the Built to Divide series. It's been a little brutal getting back to the mic, but it's time to get back to work. I have some great conversations and new episode formats coming your way, but we'll dig into that more on the next episode. Today, I'm speaking with Alex Passler about the evolving landscape of office design and co-working spaces. Alex is the founder of Valist, a premium flexible workspace operator redefining the flex office sector through landlord-led partnerships and hospitality-driven design. As a former senior executive at WeWork, Alex brings deep industry expertise to a revolutionary model that transforms how landlords monetize underutilized space while delivering five-star member experiences. In the conversation, Alex highlights the challenges of office design and co-working spaces and the innovative management model of Valist. Valist partners directly with landlords to operate premium flexible workspace under a white label management model, eliminating the lease risk that has plagued traditional flex operators while unlocking superior returns for property owners. Unlike conventional operators, Valist invests significantly in hospitality-grade experiences, institutional-level cybersecurity, and superior sound installation, setting a new standard for the industry. Alex, thank you for joining me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
To start, let's dig in a little bit of your background so our audience has a baseline understanding of where you're coming from, and then just a couple sentences on Valist.
Sure. I've been in real estate for my entire career. The majority of that is in the flexible workspace sector. You know, back in the day, it was more known as business centers, a lot of smaller offices, no real communal space, so smaller offices and meeting rooms. And it slowly began to evolve from there. I think the biggest push for that evolution was when WeWork launched, and they made it a lot more about community and about people integrating closer with each other, the workplace. So my career started at IWG, also known as Regus. I did that for many, many years and then moved across to Asia, worked for Compass, very much a similar product, and was in charge of expanding their network across Asia. Then 2015 joined WeWork as one of the first employees in Asia, actually, to build the Asia business from scratch. We expanded that to over 100 locations. And then came a point where COVID hit. We had failed our IPO attempt, and it was time for me to move on and do something different. So I started Valist. And Valist was really just taking all the learnings from the past 30 years in the industry and trying to come up with a product which benefits from all the best practice and what has and hasn't worked over the years. And we launched Valist as a pure management platform with no lease liability. And here we are today, operating in our first location in London, which is a very design-led product and very much aimed at bringing people back into the office.
Before we dig deeper into Valist, I wanted to touch on a couple things with the WeWork. Putting that into the Asian market, was there any special thoughts that you guys went into to try to tweak things, or was it just, plug and play and there was no adaptation that was required?
Well, that's a very good question. Kind of developed over the years. So initially, it was very much a plug and play. We bought the US concept and product and just started replicating it across Asia. Obviously, there are big cultural differences. So it was interesting to see how the market adapted to the WeWork product. And it was phenomenal, actually, how some very traditional work practices all of a sudden shifted through the WeWork business model and through the WeWork product. Nevertheless, we did have to localize it as we developed further into and went deeper into the Asian markets. I mean, for Japan, the product had to evolve a little bit and align a bit closer to to the Japanese culture and the work practices in these markets. So it was, we did have to evolve the product as we went.
Is there anything that comes to mind as far as that adaptation?
It's hard to pinpoint one particular thing that replicates itself throughout each market. I think we were going into markets with very different price points, with very different rents or market situations, yet our cost of building the product remained pretty similar across Asia, right? So that obviously affected margins in a greater way. And there are some markets which don't demand the level of product that we were putting in at the time. So I think adapting the actual design of the product was something that we should have done from the get-go, and it took us a few years to get there. But it's also a little bit how people work. I think in places like Japan, it's a little bit more private in how they work, a bit less community space, and in other areas where, you know, smaller breakout areas which are not huge and offer a bit more privacy. So we did have to adapt not just the product level, but also the product programming substantially.
In approaching the COVID era, what was that like for WeWork? And just was it basically a significant drop in usage and revenue was just upside down and that's just kind of how things went? Or was there something more?
No, I think there was a number of factors. I think on the sales side, on the occupancy side, sure, there was a drop in usage. Bear in mind that the way people work in any co-working, not just a WeWork, is, you know, you're sharing spaces with a lot of other people. And at the time of COVID, it's probably the last thing one wanted to do. So one was a bit more affected. Then came along the struggles that it's, you know, we were on a lease arbitrage model. So our drop in revenue obviously caused issues with the rents that we were paying in each of our assets.
So it sounds like that may have been a key learning point for you, just kind of off of what you said about Valis. Can you dig into that component a little bit more about the difference between the WeWork structure of that lease model versus what you have with Valis?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, not just COVID, but I've been in the sector a long time. So we had the dot-com bubble, which had a similar effect on this lease arbitrage model. But so over the years, we've seen it's not a fully aligned business model where you're paying rent on one end and upselling on the retail side in this market. As soon as you have an issue or situation like COVID, or even smaller dips in the market, have often seen operators struggle. So what we've done differently in Valis is moved away from that lease arbitrage model. At the same time, you also want landlords to earn a little bit more when things are going well, and then a little bit less when things are not going so well, instead of, you know, having a lease exit discussion. So we've gone on to a management platform very similar to what the hotel industry has been doing for years, and we effectively share all revenues and upsides with the landlords. So when things are going well, they're making substantial upside versus the market rent. And when things are going less well, well, they'll take a dip. But, you know, across a 10-year period, they're always winning in every example I've seen, because they avoid any, you know, lease exits or downtime.
You said 10 years. Is it like a 10-year contract where you're managing the building?
Yes.
And I assume you're not paying lease, you just, any profits they're sharing with the owner.
That's correct. It's normally always a 10-year term. And, you know, within the management agreement structure, there's a few changes and nuances that, depending on the landlord structure, landlord ownership structure, one changes. But it's correct. We're not paying a rent. You know, the revenue comes in, we pay the operating costs through the revenue waterfall, and then we share what's left after the operating costs, and that percentage may vary. In some cases, we just charge a management fee off the top line and take a small cut off the bottom. So again, there's many iterations of what a management agreement looks like. But at the end of the day, there's no fixed rent. It also allows us, I think it's not just about the math behind it, it's also about aligning closer with what the landlord has as a leasing strategy for the building. You know, when you're in a partnership such as a management agreement, landlords can often use the co-working space to sell the rest of the building, right? And it's kind of part of their entire product offering, because they're very much affected about how well it does and how it's integrated. So it's a lot about aligning the product with the rest of the leasing strategy in the building.
So you're not taking the entire building. It's some portion of it. But do you manage the entire building?
It depends. Again, as always, building the building. So at Vanish, we like to take the whole building. We like to take the whole building because we control the member experience throughout the whole asset. But in reality, if you're looking around, I think 90% of co-working spaces today, and we will end up doing the same thing eventually, is a couple of floors within a larger building. Mm-hmm. And there again, it provides a lot of benefits to the landlord. In some cases, the operator will operate the entire building, so they'll operate the reception and any kind of amenity space and conferencing that the building may have, as well as a few floors of co-working space, and then the rest is just forms part of the leasing strategy of the asset owner. But, you know, the management doesn't have to stop within the four walls of the co-working space. It can go beyond that.
Yeah, you clearly get much more control and you're not getting squeezed.
Exactly.
So as far as your design, I was looking through the website. To me, it looks like you're targeting a completely different working group with the style that you used at this first location. Is that intentional? It looks to me to be a little bit more on the professional end, less tech oriented. Is that intentional? What is your thought process on that?
Yeah, it's intentional. I think this is another big change we've seen over the recent years, especially in the last 2 or 3 years. There has been a big flight to quality in the co-working sector on the one side. On the other side, co-working is you know, getting more recognition and is booming stronger than ever before post-COVID. A lot of companies obviously looking to downsize overall footprint because they have hybrid work strategies in their company. But when they do come into the office, they really wanted to offer something more than just a desk, right? So you've got the exponential expansion of a lot of co-working companies at the moment. They're working in a mass market sector. And then you've got this other group, which are leaning towards high-end, highly amenitized spaces. So that's where we are heading in at the moment. We are designing our spaces to be less of a loud, noisy environment, more for a discerning professional who wants to come in, wants a very high level of hospitality. That's something that we're really pushing. And, you know, wants good quality workspace, you know, as well as all the amenities that come with that, whether it's F&B or gym wellness, all these kind of things. So that's definitely where we're going. We do have tech company in our first building. As a matter of fact, 70% of our members are tech companies. They're just smaller teams, maybe senior management level, which will take space in there. And so it's interesting how it's evolving.
Now, talk a little bit about that acoustic quality. I saw that mentioned a few times on the website, and I saw a lot more kind of private spaces, lots of fabrics to kind of dampen sound. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, I think one of the biggest things that we spent time on before launching our first building is, again, taking learnings from the past where we just build something and hopefully fill it. In our case, we spent a year really looking at what's really missing or what are people not spending enough focus on when designing and building a co-working space, right? So noise levels has always been an issue. You know, a lot of focus has been put on the look and feel, but a lot less has been done on things like noise levels or noise sound insulation, IT infrastructure. A lot of these things have always been overlooked. So when we designed our first building, we did spend a lot on sound insulation between offices, you know, double and triple glazing windows, sound panels in meeting rooms. And we have one of the best acoustic, I think, standards in the industry at the moment. And that's really highly appreciated and necessary when you put up a premium offering.
Yeah. I'll probably link to a past podcast that I did about acoustics and how damaging it can be for individuals over a long period of time if you have noise that it's really the cacophony of noise that really disrupts your whole biorhythm. So that's great to hear that you guys have taken that approach.
Yeah, we've definitely spent a lot of time on it.
You mentioned that the co-working space is kind of more popular than ever. What is causing that and what are you doing to sort of invite that activity?
Yeah, I think it's a number of things. Predominantly, it's still, call it three main reasons. One is interest rates and CapEx spend on building out new office spaces is becoming more of an issue for larger and smaller companies, which, you know, when they change, they don't want to spend millions of dollars filling out new office space. So they'd rather go into something that's already built, plug and play, and save on that CapEx cost. The other thing has always been flexibility to grow or contract in different market circumstances. I think a lot of huge occupiers, you know, got into pretty sticky situations in COVID when 90% of their team were working from home and there was just, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of square feet of vacant office space which weren't being used, and they were still paying rent on it. So that's an issue. But I think the newest factor, the newest driver, is getting people back into the office. And most people, you know, they can do emails, they can be on Zoom all day from home or from a coffee shop. So that isn't enough either. What you really have to do is provide an environment where actually they really want to go to, whether it's for work or not. And that, you know, that drives a little bit that flight to quality, but does a lot for amenity space. So bringing in amenities, very activated programming, where you have series of events, where you have good wellness facilities or good F&B, good coffee shop, all that kind of stuff. So bringing all these things in-house into a co-working environment has definitely raised the interest and usage across all markets.
Now, I've seen data in the past that that we were going to shift to some large percentage, I want to say almost like 75% of potential sort of consultant-based work. So companies more often, rather than having a full-time employee, farming out work to consultants at a higher percentage. Are you getting a sense of any of that? And I predict that'll be another boom for you, for the co-working industry.
Absolutely. We're seeing that in a small way. I think that also differs market to market. I think it's where we've started with our location in London. We haven't seen a tremendous uptick in consultancy work. There are other markets where we advise in where there's a lot of that going on, especially in the Middle East, and actually the Americas has picked up quite a bit on that. So I do see that as you rightly say, I do see that as another push for the co-working industry coming in the coming years.
Is there anything else that you had to think about from a construction perspective when you approached this? Aside from the acoustics, was there anything that you implemented that maybe saved you some cost on your build out or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think being able to understand how co-working environments can evolve over time is crucial. We've seen in all my stints at different operators, we've seen spending a huge amount on either customization, where a member comes in and says, I want this office, but I want to add a partitioning or take this partitioning down and join these two together. We've seen a lot of that. We've seen work patterns changing. And, you know, 1 year it's 6 people, 8 person offices, which are doing well. And 2 years later, it's 20 people offices that are doing well. So being able to adapt quickly in a, you know, relatively cost-efficient way is critical. So what we've done when we planned our building, we planned each floor a bit of a matrix style when it came to building mechanicals, Emily, and, you know, all the HVAC and the controls, and which allows us to partition the building incredibly easily without touching any of the base building or without touching any of the mechanicals, and yet having full control over everything. So that's something that we've done. It's paid off. One of our first clients moved in has really requested partitions moved and so on. So that's something that we took into account very early on. Being able to control temperature and fresh air per office, again, that forms part of a premium offering, but it's important. There are many, many things that we've looked at in a lot of detail.
To that note, a little bit on the flexibility, I came across a product. I don't know if you've seen this before, but it's sort of a raised deck for your floor, probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches. And it allows you the flexibility to run your power and data all throughout, and you can pop up ports wherever you need them, whenever you need them. And it lowers sort of your redesign costs whenever you have to move walls around. You can easily move things around. Have you seen that before? And is that something that you've considered?
Absolutely. We have that in our building. Basically, it's a raised floor where we can move floor boxes around. Again, they're also on a matrix, almost like a Tetris. You can just move floor boxes and cabling and wiring within seconds throughout the whole floor. Very practical indeed, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Alex, last question for you. With everything going on in the world, take the question where you want. What do you think is going to have the biggest impact on the future of co-working?
That's a good question. I mean, we're in uncertain times at the moment, right? With everything that's going on, both geopolitically, economically in some regions. So again, flexibility is going to be key. I think a big driver we're seeing is big building owners, property owners are also changing the way they market their space, right? They're also now having to fit out space to address the earlier issue I mentioned with companies wanting to spend less on fit out. So they're also having to fit out space. They're also having to shorten their lease terms, become more flexible due to a lot of these uncertainties globally. So I think what we will see further down the line is the whole co-working and the basic leasing strategy that landlords currently have merging closer and closer together. At the moment, you've got landlords leasing traditional floors for 10-year leases, and then you've got the co-working operators doing month-to-month or 12-month leases. I think co-working operators are now beginning to sign slightly longer terms. Landlords are just signing shorter terms, and there'll come a point in the future that it'll become all just one leasing strategy, in my opinion, where it might still be critical for the operators to stay their path will be in the hospitality and delivering the hospitality services. That's something that most landlords struggle with. So even though they can design nice space, shorten their lease terms, I think being able to offer premium hospitality is something that they struggle with. So operators will always have their place in this sector.
Well, thank you so much, Alex Passler. Alex, thank you so much for joining me. And it's Valist. For our listeners, what's the best way they can follow along with you or Valist, whichever you prefer?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, on Valist.com, we also have blog posts on there, and we can go from there to LinkedIn. We're pretty active, doing a lot around the world, not just in operating buildings, but advising landlords and operators globally. So please do reach out if you have any questions, see if we can help.
Thank you so much, Alex. Thank you for joining me. Thank you to the listeners for listening, and we will talk again on the next one. Thanks. Thanks for listening. Spaces is brought to you by Lines, my Southern California-based architecture and creative studio that provides services focused on custom homes, home renovations, creative office, and specialty retail spaces. Find out more at lines.studio. That's lines.studio. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question about the built environment or just want to share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcasts. Looking for similar content? Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, and that's gablemedia.com. And lastly, before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content from this episode, visit lines.studio/podcasts. Talk soon.